So the progress in our field is truly spectacular, and it's really heartening. Walk through the halls, and I hear the word every so often, Renaissance, and it shows up in print and in the media. And taken literally, it is a renaissance. It's a rebirth. But there's another sense to the word renaissance that has to do with a full flourishing within a culture and not just within a subculture. So if we use that higher standard of the word renaissance, I want to say it's not here yet. So the question for today is, what stands in the way between now and a renaissance? Well, a true psychedelic renaissance might have some of these properties. When the culture at large more accurately understands the psychedelics, when skilled psychedelic-assisted therapy is widely available, and when it's widely available to people without regard to their ability to pay. And then there's the mystical-type experience, non-duality, and many other names. This is the type of experience, many people will say, long after the fact, that it was one of the most important experiences or the most important experience of their entire lives. There are also psychodynamic and archetypal experiences that may come before or after that kind of experience. So for me, one mark of a psychedelic renaissance would be a time when the culture does not regard that type of seeking as odd, and when it's available with suitable containment and widespread social support as a birthright. So our field is nothing if not complex and diverse, so much so that I don't know whether to call it a field or many fields. We talk about a wide variety of substances, and we don't even agree on what is and is not a psychedelic. How about cannabis? How about ketamine? The psychedelics are used in a wide range of doses, from micro to middle to heroic. They're used in a wide variety of contexts, and they're used for a wide variety of purposes. Taken all together, the claims that are made for psychedelics are so sweeping that we shouldn't be surprised if people not in our field say, "Oh, come on, you're kidding me. Is there a single problem that your substances won't address?" So we have a tall task ahead of us, and that's to do a lot of explaining and to convey a lot of nuance until what we understand is more widely understood and accepted within the dominant culture. I think we're not out of the woods yet. Let's look at a few use cases and ask what stands between now and a renaissance. First, laboratory research. We all recognize the promise of recent reemergence of above-ground clinical research and research with healthy normal volunteers. In that field, something that can go wrong is called a serious adverse event. That's an irrelevant slide. And a serious adverse event could really set the field back, depending on how adverse it is, how the media responds, how the regulators respond. The good news is the researchers are well aware of this and understand that the safeguards that have kept the field safe so far need to be maintained throughout the clinical research. Alongside research bubbling up in various places around the world is religious use. And I mean to include a lot under that broad category of religious use. Some entheogen use, and I'll use that word, entheogen, is easily recognized as religious practice. Why? Because it has an established order of worship, a congregation, a lineage, trained leadership, a calendar of religious observances, and so on. In other words, it looks like what we think religion usually looks like. But there are other uses that still, in my view, deserve the word religion. They ought to be acknowledged as religious, although they follow different models. One is shamanism, and another is spiritual exploration among friend circles. People gathering with serious intention and appropriate safeguards, although not formalized. And then there's the whole area of retreat centers. So what could track in religious use? Well, when there's a lack of skilled, experienced, and networked leadership, people can get hurt. There can be medical emergencies, there can be lasting psychological harms, and there can be more subtle issues that I'll talk about later. So much of what we call immature religion comes from unwholesome or confused motives and from leaders overestimating their readiness to lead. The problems often emerge around money, sex, holding what you might call the chalice of revelation or other power issues. So this is a web page captured a little over a year ago. It describes the first ever legal ayahuasca retreat center in the United States. We see pictures of its leader, who writes on the right-hand side of the page, "Welcome, I'm Trinity. Who I really am is infinite, nameless, and beyond all labels and words." If you scroll down the lengthy web page, you get to more text. We are here to build 30 Ayahuasca USA retreat centers and churches in the 30 largest cities in America before 2030, our new golden age. If you go further down the webpage, you'll discover that participation in these retreats is by donation. However, the text goes on to explain that, in essence, if you're not ready to donate a lot, it probably means you're not doing enough spiritual work. And now's your golden opportunity. So the ayahuasca community responded to this informally and effectively. They wrote, "No, actually, you're not legal. Furthermore, what's your lineage? Where are your elders?" And it wasn't very long before the website was taken down. But one hears that these people are regrouping, and they may in time approach the DEA asking permission. Why did they say they were legal in the first place? The answer is they had a piece of paper, which they called a charter, from a splinter group of the Native American church called ONAC. Well, guess what? You can effectively become a charter of ONAC yourself. You can become a card-carrying member. Here I blacked out the name and the picture of the person who showed me her card. But if you go on the internet and pay money, you can become a member of this ONAC Native American church. And the back of the card informs you that being a member of ONAC qualifies this cardholder to carry and or possess Native American church sacraments, including but not limited to peyote, ayahuasca, cannabis, psilocybe mushrooms, and fungi, etc. There's no reason to think that's true. There is one sacrament in the Native American church. It's peyote. One Schedule I substance that's a sacrament. It's peyote. So somebody's making what kind of looks like a business out of selling fake stay-out-of-jail-free cards. What happens if substance-based religion becomes too hot for the culture at large to handle? Well, the culture at large has recourse. The DOJ can tighten up and say no. The courts can say no. Furthermore, the protection potentially available federally is not by constitutional law these days. It's by statute. Congress could amend the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to exclude from its purview the Controlled Substances Act, and that would be a real loss. There are some subtle ways that religious use can go off course. Houston Smith addressed this under the heading, "The Esoteric-Exoteric Divide." About Houston, he offered to the world a keen multimillennial view of religion and the place of religion in human affairs. I knew him to be an exceptionally wise and kind soul. There was not a mean bone in his body, and he was not an authoritarian. Nonetheless, he wrote, "To argue that there are things in religion that are best kept secret cuts against our democratic grain, yet tested religions do so argue. There are pearls which, cast before swine, will be damaged themselves by trampling, or will damage the swine should the swine eat them." In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna forbids imparting higher knowledge to those who are not ready for it. Either, as I have said, the subject will be damaged, or the significance of the experience will be missed and the encounter trivialized. Thus, either the subject is damaged or the Dharma is damaged, usually both. The psychedelic movement pays lip service to these dangers by advising screening and preparing subjects. But on the whole, it honors the esoteric-exoteric distinction only perfunctorily. So that was 1967, well after the printing press and before the internet. Things are way different now. This warrants more conversation than we'll have time for this afternoon. So moving on. In psychology, there is a model of personality called the Big Five. The Big Five factors are traits thought to be relatively stable throughout a life, shifting just a little bit year over year. There's experimental evidence from Hopkins, however, that major psilocybin experiences can significantly increase one of those five traits. It's called openness. That's a great thing, right? Who wouldn't want to be more open? Well, it turns out that openness is described by six subscales, two of which are the tendency to be intellectually curious and open to new ideas, and the tendency towards a vivid imagination and fantasy life. So this raises the question, where's the line between openness and gullibility? Let's talk about the New Age movement. An interviewer once asked the ecumenical Houston Smith, "What's the difference between your spiritual practices and the New Age practice of taking a bit from shamanism, a bit from Buddhism, a bit from the goddess, etc.?" And Houston replied, "What you describe as New Age, and what I call the cafeteria approach to spirituality, is not the way organisms are put together, nor great works of art. And the vital tradition is more like an organism or work of art than it is like a cafeteria tray. The New Age movement looks like a mixed bag. I see much in it that seems good. It's optimistic. It's enthusiastic. It has the capacity for belief. On the debit side, I think one needs to distinguish between belief and credulity. How deep does New Age go? Has it come to terms with radical evil? More, I'm not sure how much social conscience there is in New Age thinking. If we think, for example, that we are drawing closer to transcendence or God, but are not drawing closer in compassion and concern for our fellow human beings, we're just fooling ourselves. Do New Age groups produce a Mother Teresa or a Dalai Lama? Not that I can see. So, at its worst, it can be a kind of private escapism to titillate oneself. Here's an announcement that appeared on Facebook in March of last year. It's not atypical. It has some typos, and I'll do my best. Hello, friends. <3, heart symbol. I invite you to come out to this very special spiritual activation event. There will be very great sound healing as well. Didgeridoo Master John will be doing didgeridoo healing, as well as polyphonic pineal overtone throat singing. These vibrations bring us into a higher frequency of consciousness, as galactic star sister Jane transmits downloads to connect us to the solar disks, upgrading our DNA. I highly suggest you try to make it out. This will be a very powerful healing ceremony. I hope you can make it. It will be a trip! So I won't really comment on that, though I will acknowledge my own experience of sound as powerful. That solicitation does bring to mind the delicate question of what is and is not leading people astray. And how's a seeker, possibly with elevated openness, to discern?